I'm Kevin Davis, and this is the Catholic Family Podcast, and I've got one of the more exciting shows I've had in a while, and it's amazing how this works. It's amazing how podcasting works and internet society works, because my podcasts often come from Twitter, and I've met a lot of people on Twitter and social media who have come on the show and who have been able to provide me with really awesome topics and awesome shows, and so recently I got talking with a gal from Scotland about a different topic than we're going to talk about today. And she knows that I have a podcast, and she said, it just kind of out of the blue, she said, Hey, Kevin, my dad knows a lot about William Wallace and how Catholic William Wallace was. And there's more to it, but I'm going to let Tony explain the rest of it. But I was immediately just floored and like, oh goodness, please get me in contact with your dad. I've always had interest in William Wallace. I've always enjoyed that part of history. I'm not Scottish, but I appreciate the Scottish history and the history of William Wallace. And so we've brought in Tony Cooper to tell us, the story about William Wallace and who he truly was. And Tony, I mean, you were telling me before we started recording just a beautiful rendition of why you started to research him. So maybe if you could tell me again, what about William Wallace brought you to this story? Why did you start researching him?
Well, somewhat quickly, I was involved in the entertainment business, and I did a bit of acting and extra work, small parts. I was invited to take part in the Braveheart film, Mel Gibson's Braveheart film. And I was involved with this group called the Wallace Society. Mm-hmm. And I was in between jobs, so I could spend 6 months with this group. And I was doing a wee bit of research within the Wallace Society. And so I was then invited to go along. You know, the fellow that was running it was a fellow called Shorris Wallace. Mm-hmm. And he says, would you like to come on the Braveheart film? I said, oh, sure. And while I was there, in conversation, he said to me, you do know that William Wallace was actually the real Robin Hood? So I found that quite intriguing. And I said, so why do you say that? So he gave me a few reasons why. You know, basically, he said that Wallace had always been dressed in green. Wallace's wife was Marion Bradfoot. I said, that's quite interesting. So later, my brother, who had been at Oxford, he came back that summer, and in the conversation, asked me, how did things go with the Braveheart film? And I said, well, that was interesting. I told him about Shorris Wallace saying this about the Robin Hood connection. He said, why don't you research it? And I said, well, that's quite a task, medieval research. Right. He said, well, I'll assist. You do the writing part. Well, he kept on about it and on about it, you know, for a few weeks. He kept mentioning this. I said, okay. Eventually, I said, okay, I'll do it. And it all stems back to the historical aspect, as I was saying before we went on camera, Kevin, was I seem to have been influenced by my great-grandfather, who, according to my grandmother, was really crazy about Irish history. You know, he'd come mm-hmm. off the Irish and he knew everything about Irish history. But the Wallace thing, it was actually 5 years of work.
Wow.
It was quite a task. We got the early source, and once I started to take it from the... It's a grand epic poem. It goes on and on and on, in Old Scots.
Mm-hmm.
So that's very different from English. So it was a translation job, really, to make it into a readable modern prose. So as I translated it, more and more I saw this fellow talk about the Robin Hood.
Okay.
Seemed to some traction. And it was astonishing, actually. But as for the Catholic side of things, we discovered there was a lot more to the reason why Robin Hood was quite a mysterious character. It actually had an impact on British history and all linked to the Scottish Reformation. Wow. When they started to muddy the waters regarding the true identity and where the source of these stories came from. So just ask me any question you'd like to know.
Yeah, sure. It's really interesting. And real quick for the audience and for me, about what time of history was this taking place? This was in the
1300s? Wallace was executed in 1305.
13.
It was born around about 1270. So he was about, wow, he was about 35 years old when he was executed.
Wow.
Wallace himself had actually, his plan was to study for the priesthood.
Interesting.
And he went to a seminary in Dundee, and he formed a great relationship with one of the other seminarians called John Blair. Mm-hmm. Blair comes into the Wallace story a large amount of the time. He's one of Wallace's closest friends. And the whole reason for the Wallace history being written was at the instigation of Bishop Sinclair of Dunkeld. Mm-hmm. After Wallace had died, he insisted that the Pope should know about Wallace's life.
Okay.
So that was the reason the original book was written. There was a Latin account written by Father Blair. Now, other thing about Father Blair, he was a Benedictine.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd been what you called a cocktailed friar, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, the cocktailed friar pops up in Robin Hood as Friar Tuck.
Okay.
Cocktail just means lifting up the hem of your gown and tucking it up for horse riding, usually.
Uh-huh.
Leathered a lot of horse riding with Wallace, right, because he was on Wallace's campaigns. So it's easy to see where the Friar Tuck comes from, you know.
Right.
But I'll quickly go through a quick summary of the Wallace connections.
Mm-hmm.
And personnel. You had, as I say, Father Blair, who's a Friar Tuck. Wallace's greatest friend is Sir John de Graham, who is referred to as Leo John. Leo means loyal in Old Scots.
Uh-huh.
So this is where the Leo John comes from, you know.
Okay.
You know, which morphed into Little John, right? Leo John. He was killed at the Battle of Falkirk, and Wallace grieved very heartily over, mm-hmm, his death. As I said earlier, his wife was Lady Marion Braidfoot from Lanark, right? So that's the maid Marion. You've Alan Adale and Robin Hood.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of Robert the Bruce's titles was Lord Annandale.
Okay.
Annandale later became Annandale. Right, it's down in Galloway,
right,
in Scotland. And it was one of Bruce's territories, right? He was Lord of Annandale. So that's, so you start to see, Alan Adale.
Wow.
Then you had the Red Douglas, right? Sir William, the Red Douglas. So that's possibly and this is just speculation, this part about Douglas, that's possibly where you get the Red William or the Will Scarlet.
Right.
Right. There's quite a few others, you know, that crop up in the early Robin Hood poetry. There's names that crop up, and you see them amongst Wallace's group, these different names. There's also the aspects of things that happen, especially in the early poetry. For instance, Robin Hood, in the early Robin Hood poetry, collapses a bridge under the English soldiers. That was a tactic used by Wallace at Battle of Stirling Bridge. He actually had instructed a man. There was a family called they were always called Pinwright. Right, each oldest son was called Pinwright after the original Pinwright.
Mm-hmm.
Pinwright was a carpenter who Wallace employed to saw the boards on the bridge and to fit them with hinges.
Mm-hmm.
And they built a cradle underneath the bridge, and they de-sawn boards so that when half the English army had crossed Stirling Bridge, Wallace blew on his horn, and that was a signal for the fellas in the cradle to knock the supports away from under the boards. So what they effectively did was they cut the English army in half.
Mm-hmm.
The ones that were on the boards that collapsed, they actually went down into the River Forth and drowned. But it evened up the odds. It meant Wallace and his army could deal with it, half of the English army, because the English army was more than twice the size of the Scottish army.
Right. So
by using that, having the boards hinged, they pushed them back up again after they dealt with the guys that got across and then pursued the other half of the army. And that's how the Battle of Stirling was actually won. And very few Scots actually know that was how it was achieved.
And is that written then in the poetry, or how do you find that information?
That's in the poem, the original poem, which is a story of Wallace. There was a man, we don't know who he is, but he's known as the minstrel. Again, mm-hmm. The minstrel. This man, the minstrel, writes the poem. Now, the thing about minstrels is a minstrel is a great skill. They were actually historians who learned, mm-hmm. who were children, who were trained in creating poetry for oral histories. And they would recite the oral histories of Scotland, and they would recite the Irish minstrels and the Welsh minstrels, the Celtic thing. They learned to recite the oral histories. Mm-hmm. One of the first things that Edward the First did when he invaded Scotland and Wales was to execute the minstrels. Right. Because it was to wipe out their histories. Right. These guys are walking encyclopedias of histories. So you start to see the Irish minstrels, the Scottish minstrels had to go on the run from Edward. Another thing he did was he destroyed the library of Iona, which contained the Scottish Chronicles. It's a thing that happens throughout history a lot. One of the first things they do is to try and wipe out the culture and the history.
Right. They want to create their own, right? They want to tell the story. History is written by the victors, and they can't write the history if the history already exists, right?
It's about controlling it, and that's why that's a book that we did. And when we published this book, There was a Glasgow publisher who was very excited about it when he read the manuscript. And he actually, there's a fellow called Neil Wilson, Neil Wilson Publishing in Glasgow. And Neil Wilson was saying to me, you know, this could be a great Christmas seller. And he was penciling in a print date, and he was asking me about the format which I'd like the book in. You know, he was offering various formats. We could do it this way, we could do it that way. And he was very excited about it all. And then suddenly went cold.
Okay.
He suddenly went cold. And he came back with the excuse, I'm not going ahead with the book. And I said, why? Because an alleged historical expert had looked at the manuscript at his instigation. You know, I want you to look at this over. And they came back. And the critique, they actually used the term, it's a Catholic rant.
Wow.
I said, what? A Catholic rant? Just, he gave me two A4 typewritten pages of the critique. When I read the so-called expert's critique, I challenged it. And I said, look, some of the things that she said, it was a female, some of the things this woman is saying have been addressed in the thesis regarding dates of when the first Robin Hood poetry came out. I said, by the minstrel's text, we can assume that he's writing this thing earlier than the first Robin Hood stories have come out.
Mm-hmm.
I cited a couple of examples which proved that. I said, the minstrel wrote this poem at least 100 years before the historians say. Right? And I gave the argument and the evidence within the text itself.
Mm-hmm.
So he's talking about events which were much closer to Wallace's time. He's talking about personalities who he actually criticises in part of the poem. He criticises these people and he said, best that I lay off, because those who done these terrible deeds may do me harm. Well, mm-hmm. I knew the people the minstrel was referring to were still about in about 1340. Right.
Mm-hmm.
These guys, the Douglases had murdered Sir John Ramsay. They stabbed him to death in a dungeon. And the minstrel was criticising this as a terrible, heinous deed. And he said, best that I lay off, because those responsible may do me harm. So he's loving it at the same time as those people. You know, not 100 years later.
Right.
And the parting shot with the publisher was, he wouldn't listen to a rational argument on this. And he said, I'm just not going to do the book. And I said, look, we are right and she is wrong. I said, I've tried to explain it to you, but I said, I will find further evidence to prove the case. And which I did. We found that the earliest manuscript, an extant manuscript, was at the National Library in Scotland. And the title page says, written by Henry the Minstrel in the year 1361.
Ah, okay.
Now, that predates the very first mention of a Robin Hood, which the first mention of Robin Hood is in a poem called Piers the Ploughman, which came out in 1375.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so the Wallace story has preceded it. And it's all explained. It was all explained in the book. And actually, I got a photocopy of the cover of this very rare book in the Scottish National Library. And We actually printed it on the back cover.
Okay.
Yeah, that was just to say. And actually, when I found this book, it was through the help of a man from Kilmarnock in Ayrshire, who'd written a Wallace book. And his thesis was that Wallace may be a saint, right?
Okay.
And we'd come, independently, we didn't know this man, his name was John McGill. He'd looked at this the Wallace story and realised, wait a minute, Wallace seems to be living by the Benedictine rule.
Okay.
It made sense because John Blair was a Benedictine, right? And Wallace, as I say, was training for the priesthood along with him. So John McGill recognised the patterns in Wallace's lifestyle, and he actually wrote a book on this, and somebody gave me the book, and I got in touch with McGill, and I said, I find your thesis really interesting, because you've come to the same conclusion as we are right now, that William Wallace may actually be a saint. We've discovered that the whole purpose of having his story written up was to send to the Pope.
Wow.
So, as I say, Bishop Singler of Dunkeld had this written up and sent to the Pope. I think it was two purposes to it. One was to clarify recent Scottish history at the time, to show that Scotland had a just cause for defending the opponent. And the other was to show the sanctity of Wallace's lifestyle. What comes across from the minstrel is that Wallace agonises over whether he's doing anything or not, and he keeps praying about it. And he actually has an encounter with Our Lady in a small chapel in a place called Monkton, which is just next to the modern-day Prestwick Airport. Monkton Chapel is still standing. It's an old medieval chapel. And little at prayer in there, Wallace receives a vision. An old man appears with a sword, and presents this sword to Wallace. He said, I've been sent from the great God above to present this sword to you with which to defend your nation. And so I was curious about this business about the sword, and I obtained a software version of the Bible. And I did a word search. I just keyed in swords. And everything referring to swords, you shoot up. And then the second book of Maccabees comes up. And then an old man appears to Judas Maccabees with a sword. Saying the same thing. He's been sent with a sword to give him this sword to defend Israel. And Judas Maccabees doesn't know who the old man is. And likewise, Wallace doesn't know who the old man is. And he asks, he also sees in his vision, Judas Maccabees' vision, he sees an old man who he knows is Onias, who had been a high priest in Israel. And Onias says to him, he asked Onias who the man with the sword is, and he said, he is the great prophet Jeremiah. Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So when Wallace has this encounter and he sees the old man who presents a sword, and then the light gets even brighter, and a woman like a queen descends on a cloud, and she says, I have been sent to ask you, will you help your country? You know, he's already helping Scotland at this point, but he's basically getting asked by heaven to do it. She said, if you do as what is requested of you, You will have little happiness on earth, but eternal bliss in heaven.
Wow.
These same words are repeated 500 years later to St. Bernadette. If you do whatever requests, you will have little happiness on earth, but eternal bliss in heaven. And we start to realize, wait a minute, only through a Catholic lens can you start to understand this history. It starts to all make sense. It starts to confirm things that only a Catholic knew about St. Bernadette and what we say to St. Bernadette. And only from a Catholic Bible, in the second book of Maccabees, will you find this reference. Right?
True.
So, there was that, and there was so much Catholic sentiment throughout the whole story that when we later editions of the Wallace story, they actually removed the pieces about Our Lady. They removed a lot of the Catholic stuff, and they did the same with the earliest Robin Hood poetry. The later Robin Hood poems, Robin Hood is at loggerheads with the bishops. Right.
Mm-hmm.
The post-Reformation Robin
Hood,
his character has changed. And the early poems, it's all about Robin Hood's great love for Our Lady. All this starts to change. And in Scotland, post-Protestant Reformation, you have John Knox getting a lot pushed through that for henceforth, the celebration of Robin Hood days in Scotland shall be banned.
Wow.
And become a capital offence if you're caught celebrating Robin Hood.
When was that?
That was the mid-16th century.
Wow.
Scottish Reformation, you know, they get control, Scotland. They stitch up Mary's Queen of Scots, they kill Cardinal Beaton.
Right. And
I started to discover more and more about Knox and George Buchanan. They're both working as agents for England. Now, the Reformation in Scotland is a ploy by England to take Scotland over.
Mm-hmm.
That's what, the modern British state is formed through using the Protestantism. Now, we've got a great detail in this, and this upset the Masonic British establishment.
Sure.
So things start to make sense about the publisher going cold, and then all of a sudden a newspaper campaign starts up in the Scottish National Dailies. And suddenly William Wallace is now being portrayed as a rogue and a villain.
Wow.
But who carries out crimes against nuns and monks and priests, and he's a murderer and he's a cutthroat. For the first time, Wallace was always a hero in Scotland, but suddenly there's this whole campaign, and it's orchestrated through the press and through television. They actually start to make programs.
Wow.
I actually challenged a television producer about his program because I knew a program was going to be made about Wallace. And I thought, oh, here's a good chance to. This guy was going to make several programs he had been commissioned to do. And one of the programs was going to be about William Wallace, and one was going to be about Robin Hood.
Mm-hmm.
So I contacted by telephone and I said, I believe you've been commissioned by Channel 4 television to make these programs. I was a suggestion to make. They said, what is that? I said, you could combine the Wallace and Robin Hood into one program because of the same person. So he said to me, what makes you say that? So I gave him a few reasons. Mm-hmm. And I said, we've actually published a book on it. And he said, well, send me the book. Have a look at mm-hmm. it. Which I did. And then he didn't get back to me very quickly. And eventually I said, I'll phone this fella. His name was David Wilcox. I'll phone David Wilcox. And I said, hello, did you get the book? Well, I did get the book. But I don't agree with your thesis. I said, which part? And he had no answer. I said, there must be something you can tell me you don't agree with. What is it? I just don't agree with it, he said.
Wow.
And eventually, when I pressured him, he eventually blocked it out. I'd read your book before you sent it. I said, oh, you okay. did? Hey, but you never said. And he said that Elspeth King is a historian, a Wallace historian. And when he was doing research for the Wallace stuff, she presented her book to Wilcox and said, you must read this. These guys wow. are groundbreaking stuff, right? But we started to get signals from different people in the positions of power in the media. You start to realise they're not pleased. And it was a concerted campaign. The whole thing was we'd opened up a can of worms regarding all the sacred kind of characters in Scottish society, people like John Knox and George Buchanan. And they were angry.
And this was all after the movie Braveheart, right? This was after that was out, right? Interesting.
Yeah. Well, after the movie Braveheart, Braveheart was safe because it was only presenting a man who's fighting for political reasons, right?
Yeah.
Whereas the real story is what's motivating this man to fight the way he does is he feels he's on a sacred mission. Hey. It's hard. You can only speculate certain things. I believe personally there's something intrinsically evil in the idea of empires, right?
Yeah, colonialization.
The idea of nation states is a noble thing because it keeps a balance of power. Like Christendom operated this way. Where there was a balance of power through the idea of the divine right of kings, the anointing of kings, and empires override kingdoms. And I think it was something intrinsically evil in England's ambition to build an empire, which they eventually did as the British Empire. There's a very good book out there. I don't know if you ever came across it. It's called The Barbarian Bible. It's worth a read. And it's history from the fall of Troy to the present day.
Okay.
And it's something's done a bit tongue-in-cheek, but he gets his point across, his point being that the Roman Empire never really fell. It just moved location.
Interesting. And
his thesis is that this idea of the empire is a stepping stone, total global control. And it's moved through history. And the author contends that there are clues in the etymology of the word Caesar, Kaiser, right? Right.
Yeah.
Tsar, right. Tsar, which is like Kaiser, Caesar, right. There was different areas all vying for control of the empire. Right. The Empire sure. Hut, he kept going. And I think it's a resounding success of a thesis he's put forward. The Barbarian Bible, it's worth a read.
Okay. Good to know. Write that one down.
Yeah. And you also have a good laugh with it because he's got a good sense of humor. You know, what his main thesis is that can you recognize one true religion? Right? And it puts them all through a test. Right? The fellow says he's a Catholic writer. Right? It puts it all through a test. And it just uses basic rationales or how to recognize bogus religions. There is only one true. But it's brilliantly written.
Interesting. And I think we missed the name of your book because the screen is mirrored. So what is, maybe you can tell us, what is the name of your book?
Well, the book is actually William Wallace, Robin Hood Revealed.
Okay.
Now, we ran into a problem with it. It's out of print just now. There's a few things I've got to sort out to get it back up and running. Mm-hmm. It's also gives me time. I think it's fortuitous that because it had to end up being a what they call vanity publishing, right? Self-publishing.
Yeah.
It became a necessity because the powers that be didn't want it out there. Working from home, I actually had a house fire and I lost all the files for it. But the company that printed it should actually have a PDF version of the book. And I've got to get in touch with them to see if I can secure a copy of the original files.
Right.
Also, I want to do a wee bit of revision on it for a newer edition. It's like anything else. Nothing's ever perfect. And it's only in hindsight you start to see certain weaknesses and you think, mm-hmm. that could be better, you know. Also, mentioning Catholic aspects, there was I had a long journey to go through to try and figure out what was going on in the Catholic Church.
Sure.
And I went around about sort of journey, looking into this and that, and I actually quoted a couple of things I regret quoting because I had a sort of noble sordo mindset.
Mm-hmm.
I was writing, well, not completely, you know, I was starting to suspect there's things going on which I'm not quite understanding. So, like a lot of Catholics nowadays, you go through this journey. It takes all sorts of twists and turns.
Sure.
You've got to revise your estimation of things. Say, wait a minute. You get more and more information, and then the pieces of the jigsaw start to fall together, and the picture starts to really form. Well, at the time we were writing this book, our eyes were still clouded in mm-hmm. certain ways. And so some of that came in to try and explain some things regarding things, for example, like when we were talking about Wallace possibly being a saint, the indicators being it may be a saint, not quite realising that the whole methodology in the church for a declaration, investigation and declaration of sainthood had all been changed, the devil's advocate taken out of the picture and all that. You know,
right.
I'm right. You're saying that it would require this and it would require that. Not realising that they changed it all. Right.
Right.
It's things like that, you know, that irritate, you know, you say, oh, I wish I'd have known, you know,
right.
actually, these things.
Well, it's funny. You're the second author who's come on this podcast and said something similar, that went through a journey to get to the truth, I suppose, in state of acontism, and wrote a book in the meantime, and then came back to it kind of like, oh boy, yeah, I wish that something had been a little different. But I think it's one of those beautiful things that we can accept. You know, we can see that there is a journey, but the people who are really searching for the truth, they find it. You know, if you're looking for it, God will push you in the right direction. It may take time, but you'll get there.
You've got to love the truth. In fact, at a time we were going through bad times from the establishment, and my wife would see me getting really angry. You know, and, you know, there was nothing I could really do. To the whole establishment, and realizing that some people, if you try to tell them, might think you're just a paranoid conspiracy theorist.
Sure.
You don't understand what it's like. They use all sorts of... The first thing they try and do is ignore you. Ignore what you've done as if it doesn't exist. Then they'll start attacking the... they start sowing disinformation, historical disinformation. They start trotting out university professors who don't know what they're talking about, really.
Right.
The thing is, what we did, you got a lot of people doing studies on the Scottish Wars of Independence. You know, there's courses through universities and so on. And waxing lyrical about William Wallace. And none of these university professors has ever examined the original source or translated it.
Wow.
None of them did it. And my wife thinks I'm a bit mad, because I would say things like, you do realise, Anne, that I'm the world's expert on this. And I can say it hand in hand. I know I'm, because I know what they know and I know what they don't know.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, I was just an ordinary working man, right? And I never went to university. I thank you, good Lord, that I never went to university.
Sure.
But study... I mean, any university student will tell you anyway, they're not taken by the hand. You've got to go and do your work. You've got to investigate, study, and be like a detective, you know. And, you know, with regards to history, you've got to do detective work. You know, I'll say one last thing about the Robin Hood thing. The first mention of William Wallace in the English chronicles, in England's own chronicles, the first mention is in the Cotonian manuscript, which sits in the Bodleian Library at Oxford.
Mm-hmm.
And in that, it mentions this Scotsman, William Wallace, who lives in the forest with his followers, right, and attracts to himself people of all ages and both genders. Right. He earns his living with his bow and quiver. Right. It's
wow.
It's all a description of you think of the old Robin Hood television series, Richard Green, living in Sherwood. Another thing, Sherwood Forest. Sherwood Forest is just a few miles up the road from me. It was part of the area of Paisley. It was called the Axe Sherwood Forest.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The Axe Sherwood Forest is local. You know, they keep talking about Nottingham and the Sherwood Forest there. But the Sherwood Forest, how it comes into the Robin Hood stuff, really.
And is that in the area of Edinburgh, or where is that?
Just area of Paisley, just next to Glasgow.
Glasgow, okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's just near Glasgow.
Interesting.
There's so many Robin Hood connections. There's other things that the minstrel was mentioning, things like quite casually in his poetry, he's mentioning Dumbarton Rock, where St. Patrick was born. Right. Mm-hmm. Right, now, St. Patrick was, there's an argument about where Patrick was, but ancient Britain, the capital of ancient Britain was where Barton Rock is. It was called Alclwyd. Alclwyd mm-hmm. was the capital of ancient Strathclyde or Britain. Okay. And ancient Strathclyde went around, down the whole west coast of Britain, through what is now modern Wales, right down to Cornwall.
Mm-hmm.
The whole west side from Dumbarton was ancient Britain. And Patrick, his father, was a Romano-Brit. Right. There were obviously people that had been sent through the Roman Empire to come here, but they were Christians. And Patrick was seized, as you know, by the Irish pirates, carried off to Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
But there's so much, and also what's happened over centuries, that Scotland is a more ancient nation than England, right? Scotland was welded together by St. Columba, the Irish monk. He formed it into one nation between the Picts, mm-hmm. the Scots, and the ancient Britons. He formed it into one nation. Other things from that period that they call the Dark Ages. Dark Ages, that's just a term Protestants use, you know, for, you know,
totally
pre-Protestant Scotland. But the Arthurian legends are located here too. Hey,
in Scotland, okay.
Yeah, yeah. You had the King of Strathclyde was a... There's a couple of men who made a composite of this Arthur character, the legendary Arthur, was a composite of two actual kings. One was a Dalriadan king, and another was the King of Strathclyde. And mm-hmm. They made a composite of this Arthur character. But the King of Strathclyde was based at Dumbarton, but he also had another palace at a place next to Falkirk. It's pronounced Camelon. But it's spelled Camelon, Camelon. Right.
Sounds like Camelot, huh? Yeah.
And the
okay.
name Excalibur comes from the old place name called Caliburn. Right. This is where the sword Excalibur comes from, the Caliburn. You start to find a lot of things in the words. And the nine battles of Arthur, one of the major battles is the Battle of Airdrie. Airdrie is just north of Glasgow. Right.
Okay.
And the King of Strathclyde captured in the Caledonia Forest. It always called it the Caledonia Forest. And Arthur talks about Merlin, or Midrin. Midrin is the name.
Okay.
He's wandering. He's a druid, right? He's fought mm-hmm. the Christians. Yeah. The Kings of Strathclyde are Christians, right? But yeah. You still put the druid element, and it's fighting against the Christians. And this Midrin, who's a wizard, right? A druid wizard. He's found, after the defeat of the druids at Battle of Airdrie, he's found wandering in the Caledon Wood, and he's captured, but he's went insane. The king spares his life and holds him for the rest of his days in custody in Dumbarton Rock, on Dumbarton Rock, you know, where the king's castle is. So mm-hmm. he's held there in Dumbarton Rock. So...
Wow.
A lot of these things, it's as if they've plagiarised Scottish Scottish history, right?
And, sounds like it.
Yeah, yeah, the Liberal realised that, you know, it's funny because you start to realise, wait a minute, it's not just Robin Hood, it's King Arthur as well. And you try to tell people that. In fact, the local college, I presented a a model for a course on Arthurian and Robin Hood legends and the Celtic saints, right? Because where I stay next to the River Clyde, all of the lots of the islands and just about everywhere you go, you know, there's a Holy Loch, there's St. Munn's and Kilmun and St. Caithin and St. Blaine, all these Celtic saints. And mm-hmm. the two-way street, it's the same time as Columbus comes over to Iona, right, from Ireland. He's a contemporary with St. Mungo. And St. Mungo's St. Mungo's mother is St. Enoch. And St. Enoch was thrown off the cliffs over by Edinburgh Way, over the River Forth. And over Edinburgh, Arthur's Seat, you know, you've got the Clan MacArthur, you've got the name Arthur. Arthur actually means, it's an old Celtic word for meaning war leader. That's what it actually means.
Yeah. Okay.
It just means war leader. It's a title. It's like Robin Hood, we discovered, is actually a pejorative term for an outlaw.
Okay.
But in the chronicle at Dunbar, the monks had a chronicle at Dunbar, and in it they actually write regarding Wallace, William Wallace Scotico Elo Robin Hood, which translates roughly to the Scotsman William Wallace, who is Robin Hood. Right. That's contemporary with the times of Wallace. That's what they put in it.
Interesting.
But Robin Hood actually is actually a title for an outlaw.
Uh-huh. Robin Hood
just means an outlaw. But there's only one Robin Hood that answers to the full descriptions of the legend. You know?
Right.
Only one. And the term Robin Hood, the term English outlaw is ambiguous in regards to Wallace because the English declared him an outlaw.
Mm-hmm.
So he was an English outlaw.
Right.
But it doesn't mean he wasn't a Scottish outlaw. He was an English outlaw under their law. But
makes sense, yeah.
It doesn't mean he was an Englishman.
Right.
Right. So you start to see all these wee threads. But the main surprising thing for us was the Catholic side to things. And there was actually events after his death, which the minstrel relates. There's a very holy bishop who hears Wallace's last confession. Wallace cries out that he wants a priest before they execute him. And Edward the First shouts out, no priest is to go near him. Right.
Wow.
He doesn't want them to his confession here and absolution granted to him. But there's a very holy bishop who happens to be there, and he defies Edward. And he defies Edward by saying, I will go to hear his confession, and should you stop me, I will have England declared excommunicate.
Ooh, okay. Powerful.
Which would mean there'll be no masses, no sacraments. And the other lords hearing this told Edward, sire, desist. Because they knew that under the rules of Christendom, if a nation was declared excommunicate, then other kings surrounding it, other Catholic kings could go in and conquer it.
Right.
Right. So right. This is the power of the papacy, the real power. You know, if a bishop who would have got the green light from the Pope, yeah, they're declared excommunicate, then that country was up for grabs. So
makes sense, right?
Yeah, so this balance of power, you know.
Wow. But he was able to then hear his confession, the bishop.
Yeah, the bishop went and heard his confession, and the bishop who heard his confession, later there was miracles at his tomb.
At the bishop or at William Wallace?
The bishop's tomb. There were miracles. And the minstrel relates another story that he said, this has reached his ears from England. He's relating Blair's story, you know. But he said it reaches Scotland's ears that in England there was an old monk who's very knowledgeable in the sciences, meaning theology, right? And there was a young monk who was like a lapdog, who's always following this old monk, you know, loved to be in his company.
Mm-hmm.
The old monk was dying. So the young monk made a request to the old monk, and he said, Father, after you die, will you ask God's grace to come and let me know where you are?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And the old monk says, as much that you ask, but for you, I will make that request. So the old monk dies, and the young monk's in his cell praying for his soul. And suddenly, the old monk appears in the cell, and it has a flame above his head.
Mm-hmm.
And the young monk said, Father, where are you? And the old monk says, I'm in purgatory. And the young monk said, you're in purgatory? But you led a very holy life. I expected you to be straight to heaven. He said, I committed a sin, a terrible sin. He says, I never knew you capable to commit sins. He said, it's a sin of pride. He said, what pride? Pride in my knowledge of science, which is a vain thing because all knowledge comes from the Holy Ghost.
Wow.
And he said, how long have you got to stay in purgatory? He says, there are two who must go to heaven before me. And the young monk said, and who are those? The first is a very holy priest who constantly heard confessions hour upon hour and saved many souls. He shall go first. He says, and who's second? The one who will go second before me awaits his death in London. Now, the young monk, realizing that it could be referring to Wallace, says, you don't mean the criminal Wallace? He says, yes. He shall go to heaven before me.
Wow.
And a young monk says, but should I tell this to the brothers? They will never believe it. He said, I will give a sign that when Wallace dies, the bells of the abbey shall ring of their own accord. And so they did.
Wow.
So, you've always, that's type of stuff to relate the original stuff where you're getting informed by the minstrel who's the source. In a secular Scotland, a Protestant Scotland, and now a really a secular Scotland, that stuff's not welcome. You don't want to hear that. So, I remember at the time my brother Paul said to me, maybe she'd like a wee bit about the Catholic stuff. And I said, no. He was concerned about the negative reaction. You know?
Yeah.
I said, no, the truth is the truth. The truth is, this is what was written, you know, and this is what we're going to present.
Yeah.
As simple as that. Because, in the early 18th century, there was a man called Hamilton of Gilbertfield, right? And he did the minstrel story, and he changed stuff, right?
Okay.
And that became one of the mainstay editions. It's Hamilton of Gilbertfield's edition, which is a post-Reformation edition, really, you know. We've got to get rid of the Catholic stuff.
Sure.
Anyway, sure. Kevin, I think I've said as much as I can say. Well, I can say more, but...
I love it. No, I mean, it's been really, for me, it's been super interesting. And I think it's an incredible thought, because I've been a fan, if that's not the right word, but I've enjoyed Robin Hood since I was a kid, very much. I read the, I don't know which edition of it, but the stories of Robin Hood, and to be able to connect that to William Wallace is itself pretty cool. But then to connect that and say that Robin Hood and William Wallace are the same person, and yeah, they're a great Catholic, cherry on top. That's beautiful.
Well, he's a source. He's a source of all. There's so much more. It's overwhelming. You know, it's undeniable. This guy is Robin Hood. That's who he was. You know, the real one. This is a source of all stories. Just one more wee thing. The legend, the stories of William Tell. William Tell didn't exist. But the minstrel said the story of Wallace spread through all Europe. And again, you get this William Tell, the great archer. I believe it's William's Tale. And there's a funny connection. There's a fellow called Stolberg. And I found this there's a local library here with a lot of very rare books in it. And I found one day, before I went to do some research, I was praying and I asked God that day to lead me somewhere which will be of use in this research. And quite by chance, I just lifted a poetry book down off the shelf. And it was a compilation of poems by a local man from the 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
And in it, there was a poem called William Tell's Chapel. And once I started to read that poem, William Tell's Chapel, it describes William Wallace. Now, one of the things that Wallace, the original story tells about Wallace, is he engages in two sea battles.
Mm-hmm.
Travels to France. In William Tell's chapel poem, it tells you that William Tell fought in the mountains and on the high seas. Well, there's no high seas in Switzerland. It's a landlocked country. Right.
Right.
And the start of the poem tells you how his mother wished for him to enter the church. Right.
That sounds right. Yeah, okay.
He's trying to close them. This is Wallace's story. Hey, he wants to serve his church. And one of the things that Wallace said that when Scotland is peace, he wanted to pursue his original path to the priesthood.
Mm-hmm.
That was his plan. So, then found that Stolberg, who wrote the poem, had a curious connection. He was very friendly with Blessed Catherine Emmerich.
Interesting. Wow.
Absolutely.
Small world, huh? Yeah.
Because once I'd read the poem, I thought, I've got to know who this guy Stolberg is. And then when I started investigating Stolberg, I suddenly find this connection to the Blessed Catherine Emmerich. And I think there's no coincidences here. You know, this just falls into my hands after saying a prayer.
Sure. Yeah.
And the funny thing is that Mel Gibson claimed that just before he's put the Passion script together, that a book fell off a shelf and hit him on his shoulder or something. And it was Blessed Catherine Emmerich.
Interesting. Okay.
You see, this is weird stuff, you know. It's, you know, that if you try to tell some people this, they say, you're crazy.
You tell a traditional Catholic, though, and they'll be like, hey, that sounds about right. But that's pretty interesting you say about Blessed Anne Catherine Emmerich, because in my own fault, I always think of her as this, you know, as this visionary, obviously, and I think of what she saw. I never think of her, and again, maybe that's just me, but I think of more of what came from her rather than her herself, and yeah, that we should pray to her for her, yeah, her help in with, you know, in her intervention for our souls. That's a good reminder. So I think tonight I'm going to pray especially to Blessed Anne Catherine Emmerich. That's a good reminder, and it is. It's amazing how these things work and how they're all connected. And I think that, as you said, you know, that the world and the devil, that their primary goal is to keep us from God, right? And keep us from heaven, keep us from truth, because God is truth, right? Truth is godly. Mm-hmm. And so of course they try to suppress that. And so it doesn't surprise me whatsoever that they would try to suppress the truth of a great man and a great Catholic. And I appreciate that you have it. I want to read it. So I don't know if you're out of print, but if you have an extra book, I'm going to ask you after we stop recording, I'm going to ask you to send me one. And I hope that you get it printed again, because I hope that I'm sure that people listening and watching this show will be interested too, because it's a fascinating tale. And it's something, again, that there's always something romantic about William Wallace and Robin Hood, but then to make it even more so, to make them Catholic heroes, I mean, that's, I love it. It's beautiful.
Well, the amazing thing was that being a Scot, from when I was a little kid, I loved the idea of this man Wallace, you know.
Mm-hmm.
This guy's great.
Right.
But I still had that childlike thing about Wallace at the time Braveheart was getting made. But in the aftermath, once I started to find the full story out, I realised this was far better than Braveheart.
Yeah.
This story, and should you read this book, you'll realise this is possibly the first adventure hero story. It's like a modern adventure novel. The pace is incredible. The things that keep happening, it's like bang, bang. But you know, I've always admired the makers. I grew up a great movie buff as a kid. Mm-hmm. I was always going to see films and things, and I always liked American films because I didn't understand why, but as I got older, I started to realise what is it I like, and I found out the American writers as well. The pace, boom, 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 snappy.
Yeah.
There's no dull, dragging parts. The pace has always been good. You know, the best of American writers, the pace has always been there. I've heard English say this about Chaucer. I'd say the minstrel is the father of the modern novel.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, I would hand it to the minstrel because it precedes Chaucer, and I've read a wee bit of Chaucer and it doesn't compare. This guy is the Vince Gilligan of his day. This guy is the Breaking Bad writer, right? His pace, it's like a page turner.
Okay.
What's this guy doing next? You know, And it's that idea, fact is stranger than fiction.
Sure.
Because there's all sorts of supplementary research you do as well to say, well, let's see, could this be true? What you're saying, you know, did this happen? Was he there? So you start to do all this supplementary stuff, you know, and you end up adding a lot of footnotes that qualify a lot of what he's claiming, you know, because there's other evidence that supports what he says.
Right.
From other sources.
Wow.
It's as if you're going to do a whole empirical thing. You're looking at French history, you're looking at English history, you're looking at where's Edward at this time, you know. Can this be reconciled, what he's saying here? You know, for instance, it tells you in the poem, it's indicating that Wallace has to bury his mother, but he can't go to where she is because he's been watched for. So he asks Father Blair to go and do the funeral, right? And it indicates that it's round about Christmas. But I'm looking at the timeline and saying, no, it can't be Christmas. Somebody's made a mistake somewhere. It's not Christmas. And I'm thinking, but it's a high Catholic feast. So then I'm looking at the timeline, and then I'm looking at the not so many years before her death, there was a new feast day introduced in the church, Corpus Christi. And it falls into the right timeline, you know, of where he is at this point, and his mother dying. Again, a wee bit of speculation on my part, but it seemed to reconcile, says, no, it's not Christmas, it's something else. Somebody's made a mistake saying it's Christmas. And it just falls exactly at the time of Corpus Christi. You know?
Okay.
It's wee things like that, you know, the wee tweaks, you say, oh, wait a minute. Because everything's a puzzle. You're trying to puzzle something out. It's like detective work, you know, you're trying to find clues here and there and everywhere. But it's pretty subtle. There's only a couple of places I'd say where a slight speculation. One is the Wall Scarlet, you know, because you can never prove that, you know, but it's so similar to the Red Douglas, you know, the Red William, right? Lord Annandale, you know, is so close to Alan Adale, you know. It doesn't take much stretch of imagination to start saying, oh, wait a minute, there's things too close, they're too close. And on top of all the other actual events that tie in with the whole Robin Hood thing, I don't know anybody that's ever read a copy of this and said, oh no, I just don't see him as Robin Hood, you know. Some people come up to me and say, I just couldn't believe how much, you know, they don't start the book, you know, and they've come up and saying, I just couldn't believe how much evidence there is that convinced me this is where they get the Robin Hood.
Wow.
But, so I was the positive side of it. The negative side was feeling that the Masonic establishment has cheated a lot of people out of knowing what they should know. And it's done a great disservice to William Wallace at the end of the day. You know, it's kept his story hidden a lot.
Well, I appreciate that you're able to come on here to my small audience. It's not thousands or tens of thousands, but I hope that the people who watched this enjoyed it. And I know I did. And that's the one thing I can promise is that I appreciate it. I appreciate the story. And And again, I want a copy of the book. And I want to tell everyone who's listening to this, once I get a link to be able to buy the books, I will definitely publish it here whenever Tony is able to get it, whenever it's back and published. Because I think people would be interested. I truly do. Even Americans, even people around the world. I think it's he is a extremely well-known character. And again, to be able to connect him to Robin Hood and the faith is, that's enough.
Well, I love the way it points to Our Lady's intercession. You know, I love his trust in Our Lady. You know, he's crazy about Our Lady.
Yeah.
So he's always asking Our Lady's help. You know, pretty fascinating.
Well, that's anyway,
Kevin. Can we wrap up at that then, Kevin?
Yeah, absolutely. And those are the types of heroes that we need, right? Those heroes that were. Yeah, they were Catholic, and the ones that loved Our Lady, loved our Lord, loved God, loved truth, and that's what we need more of. So we need more of this, and we need more real heroes.
It's like the Costello's film,
right?
The Greater Glory. You know, anybody that loves the truth, watching that, they've got all choked up, thinking.
Totally.
Here's this young boy. How brave is he?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And another area of study, a lot of study I did was Joan of Arc.
Mm-hmm.
I got everything I could. I got the what's called the process, the trial notes. Right.
Okay. Interesting.
And there's another story regarding Joan of Arc. And funny enough, it's a Scottish connection. It's written by a man who fought with Scots guards along with the French against the English and Burgundians. He married the daughter of this retired Scotsman, Scots soldier, Scots officer. He married this Scots officer's daughter. And she introduced him to Joan of Arc.
Mm-hmm.
And the title of the book, which is worth a read, is A Monk from Fife.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a fascinating, to me, it would make the greatest Joan of Arc film script you could ever imagine. Just fascinating, absolutely fascinating.
Well, this sounds like a perfect second podcast, Tony. I think we need to have another podcast talking about Joan of Arc because these are stories that I think people need to hear these types of things. You know, the true side, and I've wanted to do this for a long time. I've wanted to do a series of podcasts about the truth behind history, because we all know that the history is hidden, and that the powers that be, they want us to learn falsehood. They want us to learn opposite of what actually happened, and to push under the rug, you know, the people who actually were the heroes, as it sounds like William Wallace and Joan of Arc, you know, St. Joan of Arc as well. And there are many others.
You know, Mark Twain, speaking of Joan of Arc, said that Joan of Arc is the bravest individual he ever read about. And I'd have to agree.
Yeah, sure.
Because we're talking about a young girl.
Right.
Her bravery is absolutely incredible. And her piety is incredible. And it all comes through this account, A Monk from Fife. When he comes back from France, he ends up at Pliskarden Abbey in Scotland. And in the 19th century, the monk claims that Joan of Arc gave him a copy of her ring. She had a ring which says Jesu Maria on it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And she had a copy made for his wife, right? She had when his wife died, he had a copy. He talks about having this copy of this ring. In the 19th century, during the excavations at Pliskarden Abbey, a ring a silver ring that said Jesu Maria on it was discovered. And it sits in the Scottish Museum of National Antiquities in Edinburgh.
Wow.
So it seemed to consolidate what he was saying. Well, what's the chances that a silver ring, Jesu Maria, found a location where he said he had a ring? He had that
right.
ring. So here was this story, which is a fascinating story. And it would make another great podcast about Joan of Arc. There's so much in that story.
Well, let's do that. I think I'm going to hold you to that. We're going to come back at a different time and talk about this story of St. Joan of Arc, because I think it's perfect for another podcast. We've already gone an hour 20 talking about William Wallace and Robin Hood, which I really appreciate. And I would love to have you back on. I would love to talk about St. Joan of Arc. Again, I would love to talk about other true history. I mean, just talk about history and what really happened. So I appreciate that. And again, I really appreciate you coming on, Tony.
Well, there's so much I always felt what I'd have loved to have. There's two things I'd have loved to have done in my life. But it's like the old John Lennon line. Life is what happens to you while you're busy making other plans.
Right? Yeah, right.
You end up you're doing something. I thought it was Lennon's greatest line. And one of the things is I'd have loved to have taught children history.
Mm-hmm.
I'd have loved to have taught them painting. Right? These are the two sure. things. And I think that there's nothing greater than firing up a child's imagination.
Totally.
If you fire it up to that sense of honour, duty, from a Catholic sense, you know, of honour and duty, not from a political sense, you know.
Right.
Which unfortunately... when I see a sort of misguided patriotism that takes root in people,
mm-hmm.
there's a problem for, and I think it's to do with the education in the USA. There's a problem for kids where they a sort of misguided sense of patriotism, which sometimes it's inculcated in children as my country, right or wrong, you know. They can never put their country under the lens and say, wait a minute, what my government and politicians are doing is morally wrong, right?
Right.
And I can't support that. This takes root in the... It's not just America, I see. I see it in some people with a misguided sense of Ireland. I love Ireland, but as I said to you earlier, Kevin, I've got Irish roots as well.
Right.
But sad to say, there are many who start banging a drum for certain ideas in Irish politics and all the rest of it. And politics will never solve anything. You know, the only thing you can ask for politics is pretty the right people, morally right people, attain places where decisions making's going on, you know, get there. But it's highly unlikely, you know, because the last thing, political parties are so well controlled, the last thing they want is anybody who'll come and tell the truth and say,
right,
that's wrong. It's actually a snake pit. I nearly got drawn into politics at one point in my life as well, you know. But I soon disabused the notion that I could ever do anything in politics because Catholic ideas just aren't going to run anywhere in politics.
Sure.
You're going to get chased out. So, sadly, it takes experience to realise that, you know, don't go that way. You're better than rosary. Rosary's the best, you know. That's
sure.
the best politics. Pray rosary.
Anyway. Yeah, you're exactly right. Yep, pray and I think, as you said, learn. You learn from history and be a good person. I mean, it's as simple as that. And I think it's easier to be good and to be strong, to be manly or feminine and true, you know, the true real sense if you have people to look up to. Now, the Saints are obviously the first ones that we have. We have heroes and heroines who we can look to and know for certain that they are in heaven. So for goodness sake, look to them as our heroes. But maybe William Wallace and Robin Hood are also on that list as well. So, Tony, I think we're going to wrap it up with that. Again, I would love to have you on in the future. I want to visit Scotland. Edinburgh is at the top of my list of cities I want to visit. So, I want to come and visit you, and we can have a nice chat again about Joan of Arc, St. Joan of Arc, and about William Wallace. But until next time, I really appreciate it again, and I hope you come on again. And God bless you.
Yeah, I look forward to it. Hey, Kevin. Awesome. Good night, and God bless. Take care.
Thank you. Thanks, Tony.